So ni nduwe magerina ika gugit magis bine sikwe go makwando de gavari magish kani gani jubali which. Thank you very much for the honor of being here with you, your beautiful village up here. Your beautiful village that was built in 1994. It's very nice valley. I'm sure the youths liked it quite a bit as well, say. But it's an honor to be up here, and you know, I was really happy to see all the snow. So I'm glad you all got that. It's good, because we need a lot of water. I was telling you where I'm from, which is the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota, which is kind of between Bemidji and Fargo, and Anishinaabe. That's how we call ourselves in our language. And I live on Round Lake, which I'll show you some pictures of later. Bernadette, do you want to give the wave? This is my sister Bernadette. She came up from Denver to hang out with me. As I reflected on what to talk with you about today, well, first I want to say I had a really great afternoon, and I was really grateful to be with the students at a class. But this moon in our language is called the Maybinagesis, or the sucker moon. When the suckers, that's a kind of a fish, move under the ice in our territory, that's what they call it. And then the moon that follows it in March, what was called March, is Onaabanagesis, which is the hard-crusted snow moon. Does that make sense? Yeah. And it freezes and it thaws again, and then we have this Kigali Zigigizis, which is the maple syrup moon in the area that I live in. And then we have Wabaganagizis, which is the flower moon around May. And then we have Odeimanagizis, strawberry moon. Meangizis, blueberry moon. We have a moon known as Manomanikegizis, or the wild rice making moon. That's in our territory, that's where the wild rice all grows. And then we have a moon Watabaganagesis, when the leaves change color. That's usually around September, something like that, yeah. And then we have one that is when the fall, Binakweogesis. Then we have the freezing over moon, Gashkadnogesis, Manitogesis, who is the spirit moon, and Gitchi Manitogesis, the great spirit moon. I thought you might like to hear my language. Yeah. That's Anishinaabe, which is about a third of the continent speaks the Algonquin language. But I don't know if you noticed something about that. That's like the moons in our territory, and it's not appropriate for here, but did you notice that none of those moons was named after a Roman emperor? You guys all get that, right?
Yeah.
It is possible to have an entire worldview that has nothing to do with empire. Yeah. It's okay. So I just want to let you know it's a possibility that is okay to think about that. And that's a little bit of what this lecture is about tonight. I was talking about the rights of nature, and I just put a bunch of these together. It's these pictures, but this is some art from my area. This piece is called We Are All in This Together. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's really what it is about. This guy's name is Roy Thomas. He passed away about 10 years ago, but this art is Anishinaabe style of art, and it's a different kind of art than most of you. I mean, how many of you have seen this kind of art before? A few of you? So this is from our territory, but in it you can see there's like these x-ray vision, is what you call it, so you can see inside the beings, and then there's also lines that connect the beings, which has to do with our worldview of Indinawe Mugginatook, that we are all related, which I know, you know, we're all like 99.9% the same, right? Everybody here yelled out that, which I know really bugged out the white supremacists. We're all pretty much very similar. So, but I like to show this art because I was an undergraduate at Harvard University, and when you went to study art, if you wanted to study the art of Europe, you went to the fine arts department. But if you wanted to study the art of indigenous communities or Native America, you went to anthropology. And so what I want to say is that there's a whole valuation on what is knowledge and what is valid. And it's replicated in most of our schools and our institutions of higher learning. And at this point in time, I think it might be time to question like what we are doing. And kind of in the bigger picture, what I would say is I think that maybe it is possible that the paradigm that got us into the place we're in might not be the same paradigm we need to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And so this is this moment that I believe we're at in time where we might need to think about where we're going and to be courageous about it. You know, to let go of stuff and say, I'm gonna do the best thing and I'm gonna learn, you know, from a lot of places. And so this lecture is a little bit about that process and thinking about it and thinking about where it is that we are going. Now, I don't know if I got how to do this. Oh, yeah, there you go. Which is a little bit of this question, I would say. You know? And to me, this is, you know, this moment in time that we are in, but You know, even here, I don't know the name for this mountain here, but, you know, I heard it as like the Shining Mountains, so the mountains where the spirits are. But what if we rethought where we are in North America? What if we rethought our place? Because what I'm going to suggest to you is that the Holy Land is here. It is not someplace else, but it is in fact here in North America. And in, you know, in my thinking and in my experience, there's a lot of stories that are told, but, you know, we have a place known as the place where the thunder beings rest in their migration from west to east. We have a place known as that place, a place known as the seventh resting place on our migration as Anishinaabeg. There's a place known as the place where the Great Salt Mother rests, a place known as the place where life begins. And those are all sacred places in North America, some of the many. So let me tell you a little bit about them and tell you what I think it means. This place known as the place where the thunder beings rest in their migration from west to east. You're all familiar with Lake Superior. On the North Shore, there's a city called Thunder Bay, right?
Yeah.
And that's where this place is. There's a mountain by Thunder Bay. And that mountain, in our Anishinaabeg people, would look and they would see the thunder beings as they moved and they would stay there. And so that's a place where we go to have our prayers often, you know, because we know that that's where the thunder beings come. It's a place where the thunder beings rest. And so that mountain is not called the Mountain of the Thunder Beings. That mountain is called Mount McKay, which illustrates the thing which is full on in Colorado, which is the naming of large mountains after small men. You know, I have nothing, I have no problems with men of any size. I've raised a lot of men. You know, I've raised a lot of children. And, you know, but my problem is the idea of the naming and claiming. And also the naming, and something that is about the idea of if you take something as immortal as a mountain, and you name it after something as mortal as a human, right? It kind of just blows on through, you know? And I don't know who that Bale guy was, but, you know, he's like a Bale guy who blew on through, right? You know, and so I want us to think about that, because what does that do to our knowledge of the place? If we rename things, then we forget the power of the beings that are there, right? This place of the sixth resting place of the Anishinaabeg is right next to the city of Duluth. It's known as Spirit Mountain. And there was a battle there a few years ago. I was asked to help out because the city of Duluth wanted to put a ski resort there. Yep. They have a ski resort, but they wanted to put next to the ski resort, they wanted to put a golf course. And, you know, my feeling is generally, you know, this might hit a little close to home here, you know, but we may have enough golf courses. I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure. You know, I think we may have enough.
Yeah.
You know, sacred sites, we might need those more than golf courses. Not sure. You know, I don't want to make a call on that one, but I feel like so, you know, I went to this city council meeting and I was super nervous. You know, like I was super nervous because I had to ask permission for what I was going to say. I had to ask some of our elders in our ceremonies. I said, you know, can I tell my migration story? And they're like, yeah, go do that, Winona. So I go in there and like, the room is packed. It was packed. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's like every religious denomination was in the room. You know, and all these Ojibwe's were in the room. And I went in there to the Duluth City Council and I said, you know, in our migration story, we were told to follow a shell which appeared in the sky. And the sixth place that shell stopped was here, by this mountain. And so we call this our sixth resting place. And from there it was we were told exactly where we were to go. You know, because my people have this very long migration story starting on the East Coast. And so I explained why it was really important to us. And I said, you know, what you're asking us is because we have a lot of people that are up there. And I said, you know, you're asking me for like, how sacred is it? Like, is it sacred all the time or sometimes? Like, can you pray between the sixth and seventh hole? Yeah. You know, that's what I'm saying. You understand what I'm saying? It's like, is it okay? Or, you know, can we, like, you know, have a little tournament while you're praying? I was like, you know, so I was talking to these guys and they're all looking at me and then in succession, everybody came up behind me and said pretty much the same thing. It's like, you know, we don't need a golf course. Just let those native people pray there. You know, we don't need that. Y'all should just like chill out on it. You know, so just one, there's only like one guy from the developer. It was this like guy in this bad leisure suit. It was really funny. It was like one guy and then there's everybody else. And I said, it was like, I'm done. And then the city council, this one guy in the city council stands up and he says, Ms. LeDuc, I want to ask you a question. So he has this piece of paper like this and he unfolds it and he says, Ms. LeDuc, I'm reading here in this anthropologist's report on an explorer's journal. He says, and this guy says, this anthropologist says that you're wrong. Oh. Says that in fact the Ojibwees were brought here by the French fur traders. So I want you to know that this is what it is like being a Native person in America. It's some guy with a Xerox of an anthropologist report on an explorer's journal will correct you. Right? This is what it is like being a Native person in America. But, you know, so what I said is, like, I'm sure that those explorers did pick up one Ojibwe guy. The rest of us were over here. You know, but, like, he's like, hey, I'm going to catch a ride with those guys. You know? I mean, I'm sure that that is what happened. You know, and you know, and then he told them that they had discovered something important, and it was all good. Or, but you know, these questions of what is sacred, who gets to determine it, right? You know, when it is sacred, or is there a quantification? I think are really big questions that we all have to face, and you know, we are looking at those now. These questions are, you know, carried out with the question of the Zuni, you know, Salt Lake, and here this is the Apache. It's called Oak Flats. I love this picture, this Indian woman in New York City. And you know, the question is it a sacred site or is it a place that Rio Tinto Zinc should be able to mine? You know, this is something that John McCain was very busy giving away. This here is what Apache Flats looks like, you know, and that's where they have a lot of their ceremonies. This is from Northern California, the Shasta Dam, right? And all of you know about the water crisis in California.
Yeah.
You know, these people did not cause the water crisis, but they are the people who, every time they raise the water level, they flood their culture. They flood them out, you know? And so the question is, you know, and in that case, these are the people who, the Nur is the salmon, and the salmon gave them their voice. Mm-hmm. That interesting story? And they said when the Nur disappear, that they too will disappear. And so the salmon on their river system are obliterated. But what happened is in the 1890s, some fish guy, really smart, I don't know what a fish guy is called, a fish biologist guy, but anyway, he took some of the little baby salmons or the little eggs and he put them in sphagnum moss. Check this story out. He put them in sphagnum moss and he transported them to New Zealand. You let me know how you could do that, like in the 1890s, right? Is that like a cool story? And he said, and he put them there in a river in New Zealand. And so in these people's prophecy, they talked about their fish would disappear, but they would go to a river that came from the ice. Mm-hmm. And this guy put them in a glacial river in New Zealand. And so the only remaining salmon stock that comes from the McLeod River are in New Zealand.
Wow.
And so what these people want is they want their river back, and they want their salmon back.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. Right.
This is what they look like. They're super great. This is the Wintus, Winnemem Wintus, and that's Kayleen Sisk. She's their chief. So, you know, to me, we're at this moment, and you know, in our of where we need to really figure out who we are if we live here, and kind of the question I want to ask to y'all to think about. I was hanging out with this guy named Mike Wiggins, who's a tribal chair of this reservation in Wisconsin. Called Bad River, and he's fighting this mine for about 5 years, 6, 7 years. It's called the GTAC mine, Gojibic Taconite mine. That would have just destroyed the headwaters of their river there, the Bad River going into Lake Superior. They fought it and they won. They won. You know, it's like a pretty pitched battle. But one day I'm standing with him in Bad River, and he says to me, he'd been down at the state legislature, and he says, seems like people don't want to hang around another 1,000 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the question I got. You guys want to hang out? You know, because we're talking about people who've lived here for thousands of years. And that's what we want to do, is we want to live here for thousands of years. Because that's the deal we have with the Creator. That's the covenant we have. And to me, really, the question is, you know, in all the transients, and all the, you know, what we have become in America, do you want to hang out? And how are we going to do that? You know, because to me that is very much this moment in time. So this is what this moment in time looks like at Standing Rock. Any of you here go to Standing Rock this summer? Cool. Thank you for coming on up. Thank you. And for all of you who supported us, thank you. So this is a story I want to tell you. The Miniwichoni, which is this river. You know, does a river have a right to live? Mm-hmm. You know, that's a question that should be asked in Colorado too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, where the place where you have rivers that are dead, right? Like, who gets to determine if something gets to live that the Creator put there? Who gets to determine that? You know? So this is a story about about how civil society has gone wrong. I live about 4 hours east of the Standing Rock Reservation. And I've spent about the past 10 years fighting stupid projects that come out of North Dakota. Stupid projects. And what I will tell you is that things that you know. For instance, it turns out that a state border does not contain your carbon, nor does it contain your mercury.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And so there's a set of big coal-fired generators in western North Dakota that blow mercury to my lakes. And so my lakes have fish consumption advisories on. Mm-hmm. And I come from a people that, you know, the land of 10,000 lakes. We like to eat our fish, and I can only eat a certain number of fish. And we didn't make the mercury, you know, but it's these guys out there in western North Dakota. Yep. And so over the past 4 years, my organization and my community fought a pipeline. And that was a pipeline that was originating in North Dakota in the Bakken oil fields. And you're all very familiar with fracking.
Oh, yeah.
And so those are some oil fields that are the bottom of the barrel, like the ones in Colorado. This isn't the land where oil gushes anymore. This is the land where you have to do extreme behavior. You have to do extreme things to get that oil out, right? And so there was this proposed pipeline called the Sandpiper, 640,000 barrels a day, that was intended to come from North Dakota to Lake Superior. Ooh. And in that pipeline battle, they tried to go across our reservation. And we fought them. We fought them. And on August 2nd of this year, last year, the company announced that it had canceled the Sandpiper. We were worked very hard to oppose it. And the system worked somewhat in Minnesota, but the economy worked better for us. But what happened is that that company, the Enbridge company, single largest pipeline company in North America, bought one third of the pipeline called the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so they went out there and they financed something that was not financially doing that well. And this is what it looks like. And to me, this kind of question of, did you sign up for this? Is this what it should look like in the United States in this millennium? Those are really, really significant questions, because I feel like I signed up for a society that did not injure its people to benefit corporations. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that Colorado had the Ludlow Massacre. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
But I felt almost like that's what we're looking at. Because we took thousands of rounds of rubber bullets. We took a lot of, you know, things that we shouldn't have took. That's people in the river getting sprayed.
Yeah.
You know, with mace and gases in the river. And this equipment, I had never seen until I went to North Dakota. So the piece on the right is called an MRAP. And I, you know, it's a Stetson County MRAP. Stetson County probably has 15,000 people in it, so I don't know why they need a piece of equipment like that. But that piece of equipment is called a mine-resistant armored personnel carrier. Now, to the best of my knowledge, there are no landmines in North Dakota. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that thing is intended. I had some military guys that said, what do you use that for? It says use it for plowing into the side of a building. You know, that's what you use it for. And there's really not any buildings in North Dakota.
No.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? It's like that piece of equipment is a little bit excessive. Right? And then to the left of it is this thing with this giant sound cannon that's intended to bust your eardrums. Right? And so that's what they started using on us in August. That's in August. Mm-hmm. And so what I gotta ask is, like, how militarized do you need to be? Mm-hmm. And what are you gonna do to protect the oil companies? Because I think that that is really the question that we have at the end of the fossil fuel era. And this is what it looks like when they spray you with water cannons and it's below freezing.
Yep.
So let me talk about where I think we need to go and what making America great looks like. So this is what making America great looks like. Like, what I would really like to see is a multicultural democracy. That's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see something which honors people, knows where it came from, and was about protecting the rights of Mother Earth and the rights of the people, as opposed to a country where the rights of corporations are considered natural persons under the law. So there was a time, and most of you know this story, when the founding fathers were trying to figure out how to run a democracy, having come from things like feudalism, and tyranny, and monarchy. Who would they go visit? They went and visit the Iroquois Confederacy, right? Took a bunch of notes. Representational democracy, oldest representational democracy, a series of houses. Long houses is what they're called. Through which people would, their chiefs were condoled. I really like that term, condoled. It has two reasons. One is that they're kind of like being the Dalai Lama, it's a lifetime appointment, so one passed, you're super sad. But the other thing is they give you condolences for the responsibility it takes to be a leader. Mm-hmm. You know, what a different kind of political leader that is, right? So to think about that is super important to me. And then to consider, you know, that in the represent, you know, those guys took all their notes, but they missed a lot of stuff, right? Like, yeah. Super important thing that those guys missed, who wrote the notes for the Constitution, is that women appointed the chiefs and removed the chiefs. You know, our most sacred food is wild rice. It grows on our rivers and lakes, and all you got to do is take care of those rivers and lakes, and it comes back in succession. You go with two sticks in a canoe. That's a pole. You push it, then you have these sticks, and you knock the rice into your canoe like that. And when you knock it in, then you gather it up from the bottom, and then you put it in those bags, and then you bring it in, and you lay it out to dry, and then you parch it over a fire on these drums. Go like this for about 2.5 hours, and then you drop it. And then you can dance on it to get the hulls off. And then you have like a winnow it to get the chaff off. Pretty good gift, huh? And so I went to Italy, and I hung out with all the cool rice people. So one of them comes to see me, this Thai rice farmer. And he comes and he says, "Where's your rice?" And I said, "It's over there." He said, "No, where's your rice?" I said, "No, it's right there on the lake." And what I realized is that the guy came from a place where he spent his whole life in a rice paddy. You know what I'm saying? Taking care of the rice. Their whole life was it. And the Creator gave us something that grows on the lake. And you just go out with a canoe and harvest it. You know, and to me, that is so important. Because the Creator gave, even here we were talking about harvesting, you know, along your river valleys. The Creator gave this ecosystem tremendous wealth. You know, you live in a very wealthy place. And sometimes you don't appreciate it until someone, you know, like that guy said, where's the rice? Where's the rice? I said, it's right there. And then, you know, I think we both started to cry because I didn't really think about, like, what a gift I had. And he was like, wow. You know, wow. So to me, this is what it was all about. So basically, we're at this point right now. I've lived my entire life in the fossil fuels era. Did you guys have a good time? We jetted around, we drove everywhere. You know, basically what I want is an elegant transition out. And I say that because, like, I appreciate it. But what I know is what you know, is that we are at this place now where, you know, we've combusted ourselves toward the edge of oblivion. And so in our prophecies, this is called the time of the seventh fire. And our ancestors, long time ago, our prophets said that we would have a choice between two paths. One is well-worn but scorched. The other is not well-worn and it's green. And it would be our choice upon which path to embark. And that's what our prophets told us a long time ago. And I feel like, are we still moving?
No, I'm trying to focus. My bad eyes.
Trying to focus? Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I feel like that's exactly where we are.
1800, okay, 22.
And it's not just an issue, it's not just a prophecy that reflects, oh, see, we're cruising around here. Okay, off we go. It's not just a prophecy which reflects, I believe, on Anishinaabe people. I think it's where we all are. And so, you know, this is where we are in the fossil fuel era. We I've partied, I've consumed, you know, I've consumed a good portion of the world's oil. Last 50 years, we've consumed most of the easy-to-get-to reserves, right?
Mm-hmm.
Had a grand time. And so whatever there is left is really hard to get. And so this is what it's called extreme extraction, right? It's extreme behavior when you kind of get to the bottom of the barrel and you start doing crazy stuff, essentially to make your fix, you know, to get your fix. And so what crazy stuff looks like is you blow off the top of 500 mountains in Appalachia, right? Get some coal out to ship to India because you don't even use it here in the United States. Or extreme extraction is when you drill 20,000 feet under the ocean to get some oil in. Yeah, I hope that's going to work out for you until you get the deep water horizon, right? And extreme extraction is this, which is Texas, but it could be
Texas,
Colorado.
Okay.
And y'all know that. You know, that's extreme behavior, going down, putting 602 chemicals down, like blowing up the bedrock of Mother Earth to get that last little bit of oil, right? And then extreme extraction is the tar sands. And so I feel like that, you know, I don't know if any of you have had addicts in your family. I have some addicts in my family. And do you ever notice that addicts are like a real drag to hang out with?
Yeah.
Like they do stuff like they rationalize their behavior. It's never their fault.
No.
Right? You know, there's always like some reason that it happened. And they do bad stuff. They really do bad stuff. And I feel like that's kind of where we got to. You know, it's kind of like hanging out and being a bunch of junkies, and then, you know, you go hang out with your dealer, and your dealer makes your public policies. That's what it looks like to me. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, and then we like rationalize it because we like really need it. So like I'm having this big battle in northern Minnesota with the politicians. I sat with this Beltrami County Commissioner, and he said, you know, I'd really rather have the oil delivered by pipeline and not delivered by rail. So you know what I said is I said, so would you like your heroin to come by train or by pipe? You know, because at a certain point we gotta own up to what's going on.
Yeah.
We have to own up to it. You know, and we have to figure out how to transition ourselves out. You know, and you are, you know, Colorado is in its own right an enlightened state. You know, it took a long damn time on that Columbus Street thing, but the crying out loud says that. It's like really Colorado. I don't know what else to say, but it's like said, like really Colorado on that Columbus thing. It's like you do all this other cool stuff, you all ride bikes, you got solar power, you got marijuana, and you got Columbus. I'm sorry. It's like, anyway. But, bottom of the barrel is not great even for the oil companies. So I was looking at these charts, you know, so this is the industry report. And so in the past 5 years, the bottom of the barrel hasn't even looked well for these guys. So this is net income. In 2011, they had $80.4 billion. This is the top three dudes, right?
Yeah.
You know, Exxon, Chevron, and ConocoPhillips. And in the past 5 years, that has dwindled down significantly. Can you see that? And so the question is like, if you were Rex Tillerson, remember him? The CEO of Exxon, and you lost like 70% of your net income in 5 years, where could you get a job? You could be Secretary of State, right? But so what I'm saying is that these guys are not necessarily financially stable. Their wealth is predicated on a lot of fantastic ideas, like that they will determine all of the price of oil. And as you know, as well as I do probably, that the oil in the Bakken and the oil in the tar sands doesn't get produced till about $70 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And so long as the price stays below that, these guys don't make what they need, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how it goes, but this is what we're dealing with.
Ah.
We defeated the Sandpiper in August of last year after a 4-year battle, and then they announced what we knew is a 760,000 barrel a day tar sands pipeline, coal mine 3. And we're just single largest investment. And you know, for those of us who've been watching the predator in chief, that's what we refer to him as, Mr. Trump, you know, he's kind of in the willy-nilly pipeline approval process. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
It's like, they shall be built. You know, and so, you know, of course, I think that that is bad, but also there's a real question of how much oil is actually out there.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading this Toronto Globe and Mail here a couple days ago, and they expect, he is predicting to overbuild pipelines by 1/3 of what they could possibly use. And this is what it looks like in North Dakota. So the Dakota Access Pipeline is referred to as the Dakota Access Pipeline. But we refer to it as the Dakota Access Pipeline because today in North Dakota, they're producing 900,000 barrels of oil a day. That's what's coming out of the Bakken oil fields. And the reason, so this is just like Colorado. Your wells last about 4 or 5 years and then you gotta go and make a new well because it's the bottom of the barrel, right? So you gotta keep investing money. That's why it's so expensive. Well, it's the same thing in the Bakken, but they have an 85% drop in drilling right now. Mm. Their wells are capped. The Bakken is not full of man camps. They haven't gone out. And so right now there's 900,000 barrels of oil coming out of the Bakken. And in 2019, according to Lynn Helms, the director of mines, he predicts that there's going to be 900,000 barrels of oil coming out of the Bakken, the same amount. So what I'm trying to figure out is why they need a 570,000 barrel a day pipeline so badly that they would injure hundreds of people for it. See what I'm saying? It's like a lot of greed. It's a lot of greed. It's a lot of meanness. And I'm going to just tell you honestly, I hope they choke on their greed. I hope they choke on your greed. I think karma looks like bankruptcy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what karma looks like. You know, and I don't mean to be like this, but my family took a lot of hits. We took a lot of bullets, and I lost a horse. I lost a lot of things out there, you know? But what I didn't lose is, you know, my common sense. So this is what the government proposed to us at a certain point. I don't know if you saw this, but this is the free speech area that they wanted us to all report to at Standing Rock. And this little area where we could go. And so if any of you want to know where to go to talk, that's your spot. The Army Corps of Engineers has I don't know if you are aware of the fact that the Constitution now has a geographic spot. That's your free speech zone. That's like how absurd democracy is out there. Right. So I'm going to show you what the enlightened path looks like. Now, I myself don't like to call this like alternative energy because I think that minimizes. You know, I don't like to call it conventional agriculture. I think it is like really abusive industrial agriculture. So I don't think we should call these things conventional. They're like bad practices that enlightened societies don't do. Like, you don't put a bunch of things that end with side on your food. You know what I'm saying? You know, because side is the same root as like homicide, suicide, and genocide. So why would you put a lot of stuff that ends with side in your food system, right? Enlightened people would not do that. So this is what I feel like. It's time to move on. So this is a guy from my reservation. His name is Leading Bird. This is a picture. I actually own this painting. But it's, you know, it's like what he's looking out at the future. This is what architecture on the Northern Plains looks like when you start building it. My personal feeling is that everybody in North Dakota should live in an earth lodge. Why do I think that? Because it's like way more, you know, you need to be like, what's those things over by Taos?
Earthships.
Michael Reynolds, yeah.
Yeah, like that. You know what I'm saying? Like half of us should live in it. Okay, wait. So this is what enlightenment looks like. This is a project I worked on a few years ago in the Navajo Reservation. This is the Tribal College at Shiprock. 25 kilowatts of solar on that. I worked on getting that, and that was using actually leftover money from when they closed down the Mojave Generating Station in Nevada. This is the other thing I work on, which is corn, relocalizing your local food economy.
Yeah.
You guys are all into that up here, and you like are pretty isolated. You should probably try to get most of your food grown locally anyway. Except for you probably can't support all those resorts with local food.
Yeah.
So you should just feed yourselves. This is my personal advice.
Yeah.
Be good. Well, you understand what I'm saying. This is like, that's a lot of, what do you get, like 100,000 people? That's crazy. All right, I'm gonna just leave that one. But anyways, you know, it's kind of like, should Hawaii be all local food for the Hyatt?
Yeah,
maybe. You should feed yourself for sure.
Yeah.
When I was an undergraduate at Harvard, my father came to see me, and he's a pretty old school dude. But he came to see me and he said, Winona, you're a really smart young woman, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. So there I was studying economics at Harvard trying to figure out. I was like, well, I'm so smart. I was like, no, got to record. So this is what I grow. These are old varieties. Twice the protein, half the calories of market varieties. Much higher in B vitamins, amino acids. I'm going to grow this variety out this year that's really high in antioxidants. This is Pasoli corn, right?
Oh, wow.
Hominy corn. And there are varieties that grow up here. I've grown a variety that comes out of Taos, Pueblo. You guys would probably be about like that, you know?
Yeah.
Or this Painted Mountain variety. Someone was talking about, did you grow Painted? You guys have Painted Mountain there. Yeah, right, you know that, right? So think about that, you know? And so this is like, and then the corn on the right, or left when you're looking at it, is corn. It's called Pawnee Eagle corn. That's pretty cool looking, huh? That's what agrobiodiversity does. And as far as I know, you know, the Irish potato famine should have taught us that what you need is more diversity and not less.
Yes.
Right? So go for cool crops, you know, grow them out. The thing that I like about my Bear Island Flint is first time I grew it, I thought I kind of failed. It was about this tall. And I was like, oh man, my dad's going to be mad at me. I didn't grow very good corn. But it turned out it didn't need to get tall. Because all it had to do was put on a ear. And so that corn is frost resistant and it's drought resistant. And when the big winds came through, they blew down Monsanto's varieties and mine stood. So plant for climate change. That's what smart societies would do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grow cool crops, generate some energy from, you know, you guys probably got pretty decent wind, but,
yeah.
You know, Standing Rock Reservation, that's a, you know, two big blue dots up there, man. Those guys got like class 7 wind.
Yeah.
You know, and to me the absurdity of a lot of this is that if you took the $3.9 billion that they are spending for the Dakota Access Pipeline, you could get 63,000 5-kilowatt wind solar panels for houses, right? And 323 2-megawatt wind turbines. So, you know, what is energy self-sufficiency really about? What's energy security really about? You know, so to me, what I like to see, what justice looks like, is those people get some infrastructure for them. Infrastructure for people, not for corporations. And, you know, to be honest with you, that is something that we all need. Because this country has a D in infrastructure, right? We got bridges that blow up and fall down. And it's like a disaster with infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
We could spend a lot of money putting laborers, you know, union laborers to work fixing stuff rather than not. People always say to me, why you're never going to replace present energy demand with renewables, and this is the chart I use to respond. The point is, why would you want to? 57% of your power is wasted between point of origin and point of consumption.
Transmission.
You know, everything, whether they're really ineffective mining industries or, you know, in northern Minnesota, they have a coal generator that's 82 years old. I was like, my mother is 82. You know what I'm saying? A coal generator that is 82 years old is definitely not the latest efficient technology. You know what I'm saying? It's like our stuff is like old stuff. Get efficient, be like the Germans, get all cool, you know? But why waste, you know, why would you want to replace it if you're wasting that much? And the perfect example of that is really the example of the combustion engine. You know, I was talking about it earlier, and Mara Prentice, a professor at Harvard, she did this, there was this article in the Harvard Magazine, and she's a physics professor. And she said, the reason that the fossil fuel era is going to come into, is going to end, is simple physics. She said a combustion engine is 16% efficient.
Yeah.
You know, your drivetrain, your wheels, everything in there has friction. By the time you're done, it's 16% efficient. You know how efficient an electric car is? A Tesla? 65% efficient. So why wouldn't you want to have an enlightened society that went operated on efficiency?
60%.
Right? So I had this moment about 4 years ago. I went riding my horse out in Washington, D.C. And if anybody rides, you know that that's not the place you want to ride. You know, there's like cops and sirens. lights and people with banners. I was like crying almost. It was so embarrassing. I was with my sister. She's like, shut up. I was like so afraid I was going to like run over someone because like people were taking pictures of you. I was like, of course, next to the fanciest looking Indian guy with like a full-on dress on and everyone was taking pictures of him. I was like, I'm going to run you over, lady. But anyway, I was riding my horse and I get off my horse and I go to my teepee on the Washington Mall. Is that something cool or what? This is like the no KXL Cowboys and Indians rally, right? So there's like 25 cowboys and 25 Indians riding our horses. It's pretty cool. So like I ride my horse and then I go to my teepee on the Washington Mall, which sounds really cool, right? So I'm hanging out of my teepee in the Washington Mall and then Neil Young is hanging out of my teepee in the Washington Mall. Like lots of cool people are coming to see my teepee on the Washington Mall, which is like super cool. And so then I'm sitting in my teepee on the Washington Mall and with my two 15-year-old sons, who don't think I'm so cool, of course, but really cool in the teepee. And this guy sticks his head in and he says, Ms. LeDuc, would you like to go for a ride in my car? And my boys are like, no, Mom, you are not going for a ride in that guy's car. And I'm like, why would that guy ask me like that? It's such a, like, an old pickup line. Like, you know, ask someone you don't know if you want to go for a ride in a car. And I'm looking at the guy and he said, it's a Tesla. And I was like, yes, I'd like to go for a ride. So I walk out of my teepee into a red four-door Tesla. Right? And I actually went up to see my friend Ralph Nader. Okay? So why am I telling you this story? Because that's basically what I want to do. I want to walk out of my teepee into a Tesla. That's what I get back. And that's what y'all want too. You know what I'm saying? Is we want an elegant transition. We want some style in this. I don't want to be like, you know, told that I'm going to freeze in the dark. Because I, you know, and we just have to be kind of courageous and not listen to oil companies. And here's what the future looks like. If I was investing, this is like the International Energy Agency data. And now, I don't know why they got nuclear in there. We're going to have to fix that map because it should be like in the bad department too. But the point is that all of the projections, and there are more people now employed in solar and in renewables than in the fossil fuel industry, right? And that is the future, is that. And so it's no wonder that Exxon, I feel so sad for them, is not doing so well. But what I'm saying is that what we want to be is part of the enlightened future and not hang around in this stupid plan. So this is what my investment looks like. This is some people I don't know did this. I realized it. So this was one of the many Wells Fargo banks, and isn't that a great piece of art? So it's been up in a lot of places, but you know, the investment movement around the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, is not going to stop the pipeline because of the Trump administration. Doesn't want to abide by the law. But the larger divestment movement out of fossil fuels has gained a lot of momentum. And divestment on the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, a couple weeks ago, like Seattle divested. Y'all, I don't know if you're watching this, but there's been huge numbers, billions of dollars divested. But the larger divestment movement is huge out of fossil fuels. And the reasons are some of the chart that I just showed you. But also the reasons are is that, you know, in the long term, if you want a healthy economy, you have to have a healthy planet, you know, and you aren't going to have a healthy planet if those guys get to make all the decisions. And so, you know, humbly, you know, my thinking is really is that you need to move from this into something that makes sense. And so, you know, this is my community. This is a film that was done last year called The Seventh Fire. And I live in a great place. I live in a house on the lake, but this is my village. And this is, we didn't like how this story was told, which is a story of drugs, a story of gangs, a story of violence. And we have that in my village. My village has everything you don't want to have. I mean, you guys are hanging out with me, and they invite me here, and I look all fancy and everything, but this is where I live, right? This is my community. And it's not, you know, and we don't want to live like that. A lot of bad stuff happens. Like a lot of bad stuff happened to us. And so we look around and we said, well, it looks like no one's gonna fix this for us. And so we decided to start making some change in our village. And so this is what my village looks like. Mm. We have seven of these murals. I was inspired by, I can never remember, what's that alley called?
Balmy
Alley. Balmy Alley. Right, my sister remembers everything. Balmy Alley in San Francisco, where they painted the whole, you know what I'm talking about? This is a whole alley that all the garages are painted. Each one of them is different. And so I was like, you know, I wonder if you change the way it looks in our village, if we will feel different. And so that's how we started. And so we have, you know, this, we have some solar going in. And we're the people that nothing trickles down to, right? You guys, the trickling price stopped at the edge of the valley here, right? I mean, you know what I'm saying is that there's a lot of money up here in this valley. But my community has no money. But we said, you know, and so my feeling is if we could do it, y'all could do it. That's really my feeling about these things, right? This, we started putting these solar thermal panels on our houses. And I'm trying to set up, and I am setting up a, we bought the patent or whatever, we got a technology transfer agreement, so we're going to manufacture those in my village.
Cool.
Right? And, you know, we're going to do this art, and then I have an industrial hemp permit. So I'm going to probably have to come to Colorado a lot and figure out what y'all are doing with the hemp fiber. That's interesting, huh? And there are no hemp mills now. So time to rebuild some infrastructure that makes sense for people.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we'll see, that's going to take me a little bit of work to get that hemp thing going, but I'm working on it. This is,
oh.
Is that cool or what? That's my village?
That's cool.
Little Anthony there, yeah. Be forcing him, go back and finish that, Anthony. He's from California, he's kind of chill. I was like, no, you have to finish the mural. And this is the water tower, right? Minopomatosemen, the good life, you know, the good life. So, you know, what does it all mean? In the end, you know, this is what we see for our village. This is what energy justice looks like. This is the Leech Lake Reservation, and what they want to do is a bunch of solar farms or solar gardens to power their villages and then hook them with their microgrid on their reservation, right? And Xcel, they're probably out here too. Like, these guys, you got to keep fighting them with the public utilities commissions. Because, you know, I think it was in Florida this last election, the utilities invested millions of dollars in this initiative that would have banned people from hooking their solar up to the grid. And you know what happened? The initiative got voted down. And that's what we have to do everywhere. You know, you can't build power lines for oil companies and for, you know, you need to bring power lines that distribute energy for our villages. You know, that's what the future looks like. This is my lake, my village on my lake. This is what you don't want.
Yeah.
It's what Standing Rock looks like. And you know, the thing about Standing Rock is that I raise a lot of children, and I have a lot of grandchildren in my house. And a lot of kids would call me granny. And so one day I'm sitting there typing away on my little nerdy computer at the table, and I look up, and there's like these 3 10-year-old boys. My grandson has on my helmet. It's no dapple helmet, because I had to get a helmet so I wouldn't get hit in the head with a rubber bullet at Standing Rock, right? So I got a snowmobile helmet, right? Which, you know, was a good thing. I went to the pawn shop, I got a snowmobile helmet, right? Just how you start, right? I got the snowmobile helmet, and I was telling the guys in the class earlier, and I had, you know that, what's it called? Left Hand Brewery?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? And
yeah.
So I cut the thing that says Left Hand Brewery, and I put that on the you know, because it's like, looks cool. It looks like a red hand that's like, stop, right? And then I have like the no fracking on the back, and you know, my kids are like, don't put any more stuff on because everybody's going to know it's you, so don't do that. You're trying to be like a little bit anonymous out there, so you know, you don't take the big hit, you know. But so I look over there, and my grandson is wearing my helmet. And his little buddy, and then my other grandson, one of them has a gas mask on, because I have this extra gas mask from North Dakota. And then they have like these shields of like cardboard. And I remember one of my staff, this young woman named Tara Halska, she's out there on the front lines one day, and she said, they were shooting us with tear gas. And I looked and I had a car mat in front of me. She was like, you know, with a car mat in front of her to keep from getting hit, right? And so what I saw is like 3 little boys, and they said, well, the water protectors. And so what I want to say is, it's like, you know, they may get that damn pipeline in there, And I do hope they choke on their greed, those guys from Energy Transfer Partners. You know, the whole bunch of them. You know, and I never wish that, but it's like, you know, so I don't know how to say that. Sorry about that, career. But, you know, I just feel like they're super greedy and that's wrong. But, you know, out of that, everyone in my community was, you know, got a lot of courage from watching those people. And there's a whole bunch of little people, and there's a whole bunch of big people that say, you know, I want things to be right. I want things to be right. I want people to be treated well. I don't think that corporations should be able to shoot you anymore. You know, this isn't love. You know, and the thing is that what I know that you know, and so I'm super proud of that movement of water protectors, but I also know, like, I feel like it's your shot. You know? This is the time the Creator put us here. It's your time to do whatever it is you're gonna do to try to make things better. And I was looking at this annual report of some of my favorite people, the Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation up on Pine Ridge Reservation. And I seen in their annual report they're doing like all this really cool traditional housing and renewable energy. I was reading it and I saw this quote. And I said, man, I want to use that quote, so I call up my nephew who works there, Nick Tilson. He also is facing felony charges out of North Dakota. And I said, Nick, can I use this quote? And he says, yeah. He says, but I got to tell you where this quote came from. He says, we was, a bunch of us Oglala guys, and we was going into a sweat lodge. He said, and we're going to a sweat lodge out there on Pine Ridge. He said, and we were out there, he said, we're basically talking smack. He says, we were like talking, you know, like, travel council guy did this, and my cousin did that. You know how people talk, right? You know, I know you think that all people are sacred all the time. It's just not true. We're trying. But these guys are like, you know, they're like talking smack, you know, and this and that. This guy's lazy, a bum, you know, and then they go in the lodge, and I must have carried over a little bit. They said, but he said, all of a sudden, he said, this spirit came into the lodge. That's what he told me. Because I asked about this quote. He said, this spirit came into the lodge, and this is what the spirit said. He said, this spirit said, how long are you going to let others determine the future for your children? Are we not warriors? When our ancestors went into battle, they did not know what the consequences were going to be. All they knew was that if they did nothing, things would not go well for their children. Mm-hmm. Don't operate out of a place of fear. Operate out of a place of hope. With hope, everything is possible. The time is now. That's what I said. You know, and I'm not going to forget that. I'm not going to ever forget that. You know, so however it is you determine, you know, you call it, are we not warriors? In our language, the word is Ogichida, or Ogichidapa, which means those who defend the people. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean those who launch a preemptive strike.
Yeah.
Those who defend the people. You know, and so that is really this question I have, of are we going to be those people? And are we going to be able to defend not only our rights, but also the rights of Mother Earth? Because in the end, you look out there and, you know, we have a democracy which I think has gone a little bit awry. Mm-hmm. You know, we have laws which don't protect the environment. It's not the Environmental Protection Agency, it's the Environmental Pollution Permitting Administration, right? And we have laws in this country where corporations have rights that are superior to humans. And as you all know, this society just, you know, since the Founding Fathers and since the Iroquois, the laws of the society can change. And there are a number of countries that are more enlightened with their legal institutions. And perhaps I think that it is time to have, instead of the rights of corporations be enshrined, the rights of Mother Earth be enshrined, or the rights of nature. And that you find in places like the Bolivian Constitution. You know, there's some indigenous people from South America. So I think about that, and if we're gonna make this democracy better, if we're gonna make things better, we're gonna have to think about that. Think about where we're going. Mm-hmm. So I wanna thank you for your time. Here's our organization, Honor the Earth, and I'd be happy to answer a few questions if you like, and I think we have some books that I've tried to ditch because my bags were overweight when I came.